From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Linda McCarriston's new book of poems is up for a National Book Award tomorrow. But it's filled with poems that teachers and friends urged her not to write, angry poems about how her father sexually abused her and her mother. On today's Fresh Air, McCarriston reads and discusses some very disturbing poems. Also today, architectural historian Vincent Scully talks with us about the state of the American city. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new show from Stephen Bochco, the man who brought us Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and did I mention Doogie Howser? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has failed to override President Bush's veto of a bill that would have allowed federally funded health clinics to give information about abortions. The provision was part of a $205 billion spending bill. In a vote that took place just hours after the president's veto, Democratic leaders fell 12 votes short of the two-thirds majority needed to override. The vote was 276 to 156. It marked the 24th time that President Bush has successfully vetoed a measure. The vote marked a defeat for House Speaker Thomas Foley, who'd predicted that the override would succeed. In debate on the measure, the president's supporters argued that it was a vote on abortion itself, while opponents said the administration rule was interference in doctor-patient relationships. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has reappointed Eduard Shevardnadze as the Soviet Union's foreign minister. Here's more from NPR's Mike Schuster in Moscow.
According to Soviet television, Gorbachev signed a decree today naming Shevardnadze to the post he resigned last December. Shevardnadze had been foreign minister from 1985 to 1990, but he resigned under intense pressure from Kremlin conservatives, who disapproved of Shevardnadze's shepherding of Soviet foreign policy through the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and a pioneering series of arms negotiations with the United States. At the time of his resignation, Shevardnadze warned of the possibility of a coup against Gorbachev and of a new dictatorship in the Soviet Union. In August, his words became prophetic, and he stood firmly against the coup that failed. Gorbachev has named the current foreign minister, Boris Pankin, Moscow's new ambassador to Great Britain. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
A federal judge in Miami today issued a temporary restraining order prohibiting the U.S. government from sending any more Haitians back to their homeland. From Miami, Doug Phillips filed this report.
The judge's order came following an emergency hearing requested by Miami's Haitian Refugee Center. Ira Kurzban is one of its lawyers.
There is to now be a total halt to any deportations to the military junta in Haiti.
The September overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide threw the U.S. immigration policy toward Haitians into disarray. Kurzban says it's illogical to send the Haitians back to a government the U.S. has officially repudiated. There's no guarantee today's temporary order will become permanent after a full legal hearing is held, and the ruling came too late for 300 Haitians returned to their homeland by the Coast Guard earlier today. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
Stock prices fell again today on Wall Street, reflecting worries that the nation's economy is slipping back into recession. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 41 points to finish the day at 2,931.57. Declines led advances by more than 4-1 in heavy trading of about 241 million shares. This is NPR News. Thousands of refugees fled the fallen Croatian stronghold of Vukovar today as the Yugoslav Federal Army consolidated its control of the city. Cyrus Vance, the United Nations Special Envoy, visited Vukovar today and said that the damage there is worse than anyone expected. He called for the immediate deployment of peacekeeping troops. New research presented in the Journal of the American Medical Association shows the AIDS drug AZT works equally well in patients of different races. NPR's Michael Scholar says the news is welcome because an earlier study hinted that African Americans benefited less from the drug than whites.
When researchers started trials to test AZT as a treatment for AIDS, most of the patients under study were gay white men. That was one of the first groups to be infected with the AIDS virus and a group that readily cooperated with researchers. But after tests showed AZT was effective, some doctors wondered if the drug worked as well for African Americans, Hispanics, women, and IV drug users. That's because some treatments don't act the same way in different people. The question became urgent when one study suggested AZT might not work well for all groups. But now two new studies, which carefully analyzed data from several AZT tests, conclude the drug is equally effective for all people. Still, researchers say minorities and drug users are less likely to see doctors, and so they are less likely than others to get AZT early on when it is most helpful. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
There was troubling news for the U.S. balance of trade with other countries today. The Commerce Department reported that the gap between what the United States imports and what it sells abroad grew by 4% in September. The news was disturbing because the economic downturn has made U.S. goods slightly more competitive overseas, improving the balance of trade. Analysts said that American exports have been having a harder time as the recession hits foreign economies. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow evening, the winners of this year's National Book Awards will be announced at a dinner in Manhattan. My guest, Linda McCarriston, is one of the four nominees in the poetry category. The poems in her new book, Eva Mary, are so personal and so disturbing, she had been cautioned against writing and publishing them. The subject of this new book is how her father sexually and physically abused her and her mother. The book has already won the 1991 Terence Dupré Prize for Poetry, an award named in honor of the late author who is best known for his study of life in Hitler's death camps. Eva Mary is McCarriston's second collection of poems. McCarriston grew up outside of Boston in a working-class tenement. She now lives in Vermont. This is the first poem she wrote about her father's abuse. She told me she wrote it to directly address the institutional powers that have allowed domestic violence to continue, like the judge who sent her father back home. Here's Linda McCarriston.
To Judge Phelan, dead long enough, a summons. Your Honor, when my mother stood before you with her routine domestic plea, after weeks of waiting for speech to return to her body, with her homemade 40s hairdo, her face purple still under pancake, her jaw off just a little, her holy of holies healing, her breasts wrung, her heart, the bursting heart of someone snagged among rocks deep in a shark pool. No, not someone, but a woman there, snagged with her babies, by them, in one of hope's pedestrian, brutal turns. When, in the tones of parlors overlooking the harbor, you admonished that, for the sake of the family, the wife must take the husband back to her bed. What you willed not to see before you was a woman risen clean to the surface, a woman who, with one arm flailing, held up with the other her actual burdens of flesh. When you clamped to her leg the chain of justice, you ferried us back down to the law, the black ice eye, the maw, the mako that circles the kitchen table nightly. What did you make of the words she told you not to have heard her, not to have seen her there? Almost forgivable ignorance, you were not the fist, the boot, or the blade, but the jaded, corrective ear and eye at the limits of her world. Now I will you to see her as she was, to ride your own words back into light. I call your spirit home again, divesting you of robe and bench, the fine white hand and half-lit Irish eye. Tonight, put on a body in the trailer down the road, where your father, when he can't get it up, makes love to your mother with a rifle. Let your name be Eva Mary. Let your hour of birth be dawn. Let your life be long and common, and your flesh endure.
That's Linda McCarriston reading a poem from her new collection, Eva Mary. Were you at this trial that your mother was at? I'm assuming that this is based on an incident that really happened to you.
No, this is actually when I was very, very young, and I was not there. And this is drawn from her recounting of her efforts to divorce my father, to leave him. and going before this particular judge in these conditions, and having this particular judge tell her that the judge was an Irish Catholic, my father was an Irish Catholic, and the family mattered most of all, and she was to go back home.
Linda, this book is almost all about sexual and physical abuse, and reading it, I thought, well, that you might be just consumed by these feelings and perhaps thought of nothing else. Now, I was just looking through your first book of poems, published in 1984, and they have a completely different tone. They're poems about love and children and animals. I mean, there's both joy and pain in the books. When did you start writing this series of poems about abuse that are collected in your new book?
Many of my teachers who felt that I was potentially a good writer felt that it would damage my hope of success if I insisted on writing this work, and really encouraged me to write the other poems, the poems that were more allusive. I think much of the emotional content of the first book is very much the same as the second book. I think the second book has a great deal of love in it. It simply shows through to the grief and outrage. And the poems that actually comprise the second book were being written, beginning to be written, by the end of the first book, which was about 84. I wrote them and put them away. I really did not share them with anyone because they were very frightening to me, frightening to imagine my sharing with anyone. And I can remember the very first time that I did share this particular poem with a group of people at a reading, I simply shook the entire time I read it, not with anger or hatred, but with fear. I shook with fear that some man in the audience would rise up and shoot me. I shook with fear because my father at that point was still alive, and I thought he would hear of it and come to me and shoot me. I really did. I wrote these poems with a great deal of fear.
Did your father ever find out about the poems?
They were published in Boston before his death, and he never made... By that time, I no longer had a connection with my father. I don't believe he would have seen these poems. He would not have been likely to read them.
What about your mother? Because by you making a public statement about this, you were making a public statement about her life, too.
She actually has been very supportive of this work. And I don't know if you can, I don't know what kinds of obscenity you can say on the air. I don't know if I can quote her. But she said, I knew I didn't go through all that blank for nothing. She said, I knew I didn't go through all that blank for nothing. I knew there was some reason for that suffering. And she felt that if I could make this use of that suffering, she was willing to have me do it, and she has never objected to these poems. Partly, of course, they really valorize her life, which I think deserves valorization.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Linda McCarriston, and her new collection of poems, Eva Mary, has been nominated for a National Book Award. There's another poem I want you to read now, and it's called Hotel Nights with My Mother.
There was a particular hotel in Lynn, Massachusetts that we would run to when there really were no more relatives that we could run to, and my mother could continue to save face. This is a poem about it. Hotel Nights with My Mother. The hometown flophouse was what she could afford the nights he came after us with a knife. I'd grab my books, already dreading the next day's explanations of homework undone. I ran out of paper. The lies I'd invent, standing in front of the nuns in the clothes I'd lain in, full-bladdered all night, a flimsy chair-braced door between us and the hallway's impersonal riot. Years later, then, in the next city, standing before my first class, I scanned the rows of faces, their cumulative skill in the brilliant adolescent dances of self-presentation, of hiding. New teacher, looking young, seeming gullible, I know, I let them give me any excuse and took it. I was watching them all for the dark circled eyes, yesterday's crumpled costume, the marks, the sorrowful coloring of marks, the cuticles flaming and torn. I made of myself each day a chink a few might pass through unscathed.
How often did you and your mother have to flee to the flophouse to get away from your father?
Oh, my. How often? It was very regular and very frequent. I wouldn't say it was every week, but I would say it was probably every month, maybe more often than once a month.
There's a line I particularly like in your poem. I'd invent standing in front of the nuns in the clothes I'd laid in full-bladdered all night.
Mm-hmm.
Was the bathroom in the hall?
Yes.
So you couldn't get out of the room to use it because there were always fights in the hall?
Yes.
That must have made it all really particularly horrible because you can't relax and you can't sleep when you need the bathroom and you can't use it.
No, it was one of the tiny little details of this way of life. Which is so minor, and yet I do remember that particularly vividly, bracing the door with a chair and hearing drunken men out in the hall fighting. At least they weren't our drunken men, and they were fighting with each other, and the bathroom was out there, and my mother was beside herself, terrified, powerless, furious, beaten, and I was there with a couple of books, whatever I could grab, and wearing the same clothes and not being able to go to the bathroom all night. And then going to school the next morning to St. Mary's High School and having to fake. Not being able to go in and say, hey, you know what I did last night? You know where I spent last night? Being ashamed, leaving that hotel in downtown Lynn and walking a very circuitous route so that I wouldn't let on that I was not coming from home. So that I wouldn't have to have the humiliation of acknowledging the situation.
The nights that you spent in this flop house, did you think, well, is my life like their lives, like the lives of everybody else who lives here? Will I end up a drunk who fights in the hall like these people do because I'm here so much?
No, I didn't. I didn't have that thought at all. There are some other poems in the book that, and some poems I've been working on recently in which particular moments of sanity made their way to me. Little glimmers, little images, odd things, different things. And I would attach myself to those as possibilities for a way to live, a way to be human. The chief of the ways that I attached myself to was animals, which are very important in both of my books and very important in the work I'm doing now, that there seemed to me to be a level of consistency and sanity, of dignity, of peace, predictability, of lovingness among animals that I did not experience in my human community. And so I watched animals. I tried to learn from animals. I identified with animals. I never, when I was in this particular experience, when I was in my own home, I felt that I was in the grip of something. I was homesick. I was never at home in it. It never seemed correct to me. It never seemed right or inevitable. It seemed tremendously insane, and it seemed to me that if I could simply stay alive, hunker down, hide my soul someplace, sooner or later I could get out. I could get out, and it would be different.
Well, I want to talk with you more and have you read another poem, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is poet Linda McCarriston, and her new collection of poems, Eva Mary, has been nominated for a National Book Award. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet Linda McCarriston is my guest. I wanted to ask you to read another poem now, and this is a poem about how your father abused you, and the poem is called A Castle in Lynn.
A castle in Lynn. In the hometown tonight, in the quiet before sleep, a man strokes himself in the darkened theater of memory. Best old remembrance, he gets to play it as slow as he needs. as his hand, savvy tart of a million reruns, plays the tune, plays the parts. Now hand is the hard bottom of the girl. Now hand is full of the full new breast. Now hand, square hand, cruel as a spade, splits the green girlwood of her body. No one can take this from him now, ever, though she is for years a mother and worn, and he is too old to force any again. His cap hangs on a peg by the door, plaid wool of an elderly working man's park bench decline. I got there before the boys did, he knows, hearing back to her pleading, back to her sobbing, to his own voice over, like his body over hers. Laughter, mocking, the elemental voice of the cock, unhearted in its own quarter. A man is king in his own castle, he can still say, having got what he wanted. In a lifetime of used ones, second hand, one girl he could spill like a shot of whiskey. The whore only he could call daughter.
I'm not sure what image I could think of that would be more horrible than imagining your father masturbating to memories of how he abused you when you were young.
It took my realizing that that was a very real possibility for me to really get mad. And again, I'm not inclined to write poems about things that I've seen expressed well elsewhere. And it seems to me that each of these poems is not only Linda McCarriston's personal experience, but it is a realization that seems to me probably pretty consistent, pretty universal as part of the web of this kind of experience.
Did your mother know that your father was sexually abusing you?
She claims not to have known. She was so beaten, so battered herself, suffered such violent domestic rape, and was working in a very arduous job in a meat room of a supermarket, wrapping meat in a refrigerator room with her face all black and blue and red and purple. And also she was keeping the food on the table. And she went to the judge, she went to the doctor, she went to the lawyer, she went to the priest, and everyone said the same thing. And I think...
They said, stay with your husband?
Of course. Yeah, you made your bed, you lie in it. We can't do anything about this lady. And essentially, I think at some level that she did know. And at another level, she couldn't afford to know.
Did you ever succeed in getting your father to stop at all?
Well, I did, actually. First of all, I will say that I decided when I was young that I was going to kill my father because I was the youngest in the family, and I felt I had the best chance of not going to jail. And I felt that my mother would be put in jail, and my brother, who was 7 years older than me and even more fearful of my father than I was, would be put into jail. And I really... I went into their bedroom with a knife one night, and I'm writing about that now, in fact, and my mother rose and stopped me. There was a point at which I remember getting up from my father's bed he was being sexually abusive and then horribly physically abusive, I mean, kicking me around the floor, and just crying and crying and crying and crying and crying and crying and saying, you can't do this to me anymore. And I don't remember whether it went on after that or whether it went on as badly or in the same ways. Eventually, it stopped. And again, I can't even remember exactly when it stopped. But I do remember asserting a certain power to him, even when I couldn't, I couldn't tell anyone. I mean, he threatened me if I told anyone. But I did assert myself to my father, and then later in life, I did write him a letter and say, before you die, we have a chance, either with my therapist or your priest, to discuss what happened. And he said, It never happened. You're crazy. And then he called my mother and said, little girls can be very seductive. It was all her fault.
Wow.
Well, that's textbook. That's textbook. Abuser response.
What'd your mother say?
My mother said to him that she wished she'd killed him. And this is terrible, you know, Terry, and on the one hand, I feel like I'm standing here very, very naked, and I could not possibly reveal myself in this way on National Public Radio if I didn't know how many families share, if not exactly the same brutality, if not exactly the degree of madness, this problem.
When did you start finding books, and when did you start thinking about writing yourself?
I wrote always. My home had no books. There was not a book in my house. And when I was young, when I was alone, I would be outside in the oak trees, or I would be drawing and writing. Writing stories, writing poems, drawing pictures of horses, particularly. And I always wrote. And I think that's probably the only reason I ever got through school. I was a terrible student in every subject. I was a disturbed kid in a lot of ways. But I wrote. I always wrote. And I won all the prizes in grammar school and all the prizes in high school and all the prizes in college. But I was a working class female, Irish Catholic working class girl, and there was no one who really was able to say to me, you know, Linda, you could make a life as a writer.
I feel like when we end this interview now, our listeners will know a lot, and I will know a lot, or at least something of what your life was like when you were young, or at least what a small part of your life was like when you were young, but we'll know very little about who you are now. Can we just end with some sense of what your life is like now, what you've been doing?
Yes. This year I, through having set aside the funds from a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship Grant, I have taken this year, and I'm working on my writing. All of the children have grown and left the house, so I'm free for the first time in my life to live daily as a writer in a wonderful, old, cranky, big house in a little village in Vermont, where my two horses are outside the kitchen door and my two dogs and cats are inside the kitchen door. And I'm very, very happy at this moment, finally free to give my day to my work, to put my work at the center of my day. For 25 years, family concerns, children have really been the center of my day. And I've had to work in addition to that, which has meant that I've always written very much around the edges of my domestic commitment. So today I live in Vermont. I live a very simple life. From the time I grew up in Lynn, I always wanted to live in northern New England, have a horse, and never wear anything except blue jeans. And I live quietly and independently with many friends, and presently am really loving the first year of my life as a writer.
Well, Linda McCarriston, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very, very much, Terry, for inviting me to talk with you. It's been a pleasure.
And Linda McCarriston is the author of a new collection of poems called Eva Mary, just published by Tri-Quarterly Books. The book has been nominated for a National Book Award, and tomorrow, at a dinner, we'll find out who won the National Book Award for Poetry. Thank you again, Linda.
You're very welcome, Terry. Thank you.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many American cities have beautiful new buildings in their skylines, but the cities themselves are falling apart. Coming up, we talk about the shape of American cities today with architecture historian and Yale professor emeritus Vincent Scully. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Civil Wars. It's a new drama about the trials of two divorce lawyers, and David says it's the best new drama of the year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. One-time Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze has been named to that post again. He quit the job almost 1 year ago after being one of Soviet President Gorbachev's closest allies. Since then, Shevardnadze has warned that a second Soviet coup attempt is possible if food shortages and other problems create unrest in urban centers. In Yugoslavia, UN envoy Cyrus Vance went to a refugee camp near the Croatian city of Vukovar, captured yesterday by Federal Army forces. Vance, now on a special peace mission, said the suffering that he saw there was even worse than he had feared. NPR's Tom Gelton has more.
The scene of death and destruction in Vukovar has impressed all those who have been there. Vance said his experience in Vukovar made him more determined than ever to push for a peaceful solution to the Yugoslav civil war. He's here to discuss the possibility of establishing a United Nations peacekeeping force in the war zones. Serbian and Croatian leaders have both said they'd support such a force, but the sides disagree on where it should be stationed. The Serbs want it along the current war front. Croatian officials say that would allow the Federal Army to remain in control of Croatian territory. The Croats want the force positioned along the Serbian-Croatian border. The discussions may, however, be premature. UN officials emphasize no peacekeeping force will be sent here until a ceasefire is firmly established, and there were new reports today of fighting in places across Croatia. I'm Tom Gelton in Zagreb.
300 more Haitian boat people were returned to their country this morning after being picked up at sea by the U.S. Coast Guard. A spokesman said about 1,500 more refugees remain on board five other American ships. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Port-au-Prince.
The Coast Guard cutter Dallas became the second American vessel to unload its human cargo here in the past 24 hours. It steamed into Port-au-Prince this morning with 315 Haitians, intercepted aboard several dangerously overcrowded boats since the military coup here 7 weeks ago. Despite the ongoing military repression in Haiti, a Coast Guard spokesman said the refugees had all cited economic reasons for leaving their country, disqualifying them for asylum. The repatriated boat people included men, women, and several children, even a six-month-old baby. They were met at the dock by American embassy officials and members of the Haitian Red Cross, who gave each person the equivalent of $7 for transport home. Many seemed relieved to be back on dry land after weeks at sea. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 41 points to close at 2,931.57 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House today failed to override a presidential veto of a bill that would have allowed abortion counseling at clinics receiving federal money. The failure to override the veto of the so-called gag rule in abortion information kept the president's unbroken record of vetoes. The vote in the House was 276 to 156 to override Mr. Bush's veto of the $205 billion money bill. The vote taken just hours after the presidential veto was only 12 votes short of the two-thirds needed to override. In Miami, a former member of Colombia's Medellin cartel took the stand today in the drug trafficking trial of General Manuel Noriega. Melissa Mancini has more.
Cartel member Carlos Leder said he thought Noriega was just another criminally corrupt police officer. Leder alleged Noriega beat, tortured, and extorted money from Colombian drug smugglers in the early 1980s. The Colombian said he had been told by one smuggler Noriega had extorted over $200,000 from him. Leder was convicted in 1988 of federal drug conspiracy and trafficking. This past summer, he signed a cooperation agreement with the U.S. government. In exchange for his testimony against Noriega, the government has agreed to ease the terms of Leder's life sentence. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
According to a Soviet official, the group of seven industrialized nations has proposed a one-year ban on interest payments on the Soviet foreign debt, while at the same time offering a $1 billion bridge loan. These offers came after eight Soviet republics said that they would take responsibility for paying back the foreign debt, estimated at up to $81 billion. Four other Soviet republics refused to make a firm commitment. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Vincent Scully may not have changed the look of American cities, but a lot of his students have. For over 40 years, he's taught the history of art and architecture at Yale University, where he's now professor emeritus. The architect Philip Johnson has called Scully the most influential architecture teacher ever. Scully has a new book called Architecture, the Natural and the Man-Made, and he wrote the introduction to the catalog accompanying a traveling exhibition of the work of architect Louis Kahn. The show is currently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. On a recent visit to the Philadelphia Museum of Art to discuss Kahn's work, Scully stopped by our studios. I asked if he's wanted to leave his undergraduate students with any new ways of seeing the world.
Well, I think that the main points that have maybe evolved over the decades, the fact that architecture is the creation of the whole human environment. It's not the individual building standing on one finger by itself. And with that idea of every building having to be different from every other one, and invention, we destroyed our cities, along with other things, along with the automobile and so on. And what is I've tried to now teach is the relation of everything to everything else, the relation of the man-made to the natural world, the relation of everything man-made to everything else to make the city, to make the human habitation. So that's basically what I stress and what I try to teach. And I've tried to play a part in breaking up the jealous, hermetic aesthetic of the international style, which I think was destructive, which certainly was an aesthetic which despised our urban fabric, the whole traditional urban fabric, and went a long way toward destroying it, and tried to play a part in that revival of the vernacular and classical traditions of architecture, which is, I think, the most important thing that's been happening in the last 30 years or so.
When you talk about the international style that you were critical of, you're talking about those tall glass and steel office buildings.
Yeah, and I think of those tall, flat-topped slabs which dominate the skyline of all our cities now, and which are so unlike, say, the early skyscrapers of New York, all of which point, each one of which is a spire, each one of which is in a kind of lively competition with each other, each one of which is involved in a kind of fantasy. Because after all, what is the tall office building? To use a Venturi phrase, it's a basically dumb project compared with churches or temples or city halls that used to dominate our skylines. This is, after all, a place where people sit around and do humdrum tasks all the time in the same kinds of offices. And how to make that kind of building able to shape a city in a way that involves your affection and your love and your interest, the early architects understood. They made each one a great fantasy, pointing and so on. And, of course, architects have been trying to do that now, again, for the last 10 or 15 years. They've been trying to redesign the skyscraper to make it once more a mid-space element that points up and can stand in the middle of space like a spire rather than like a flat-top slab, which, you see, doesn't communicate with anything.
Can you think of an American city whose skyline has changed recently?
Oh, well, Philadelphia is a good example, certainly. You know, in the hotel last night, one of the nice things about it was we had a great view of the skyline. And at night, you know, it's all illuminated now in Philadelphia, isn't it? And that skyline is magic. And indeed, the profiles of American cities are once again taking on that splendid fantasy that they had in downtown New York in the early 20th century. When the light comes on, though, when the day comes, some of those new buildings, which look wonderful at night, look a little tawdry. And the sense is that some of them are a little shoddy. I won't name any names, say, in Philadelphia, but some of them look, when you get close, they look like junk.
Why not name a name? It's a building.
Well, I think the big Yon building that dominates the skyline now, it looks wonderful at night. But when you see it in the full light of day, it looks pretty tinsely and rackety. And I must say, the skyscrapers of the 20s and 30s didn't look like that.
This is a building you're referring to in Philadelphia that is modeled in some way on the New York Chrysler Building.
Very much.
It means to be very Art Deco.
Very much.
But
if you put it together with the Chrysler Building,
yeah.
Chrysler Building is so much denser, and its surface is so much more permanent and solid, and its wonderful rays at the top really have a kind of passionate lift, where these are kind of bent down, drooling down, lifting up. It's wonderful at night, though. And I think it's a better thing to do than some of the older skyscrapers, the international skyscrapers that in Philadelphia and elsewhere that just go up and stop as slabs. It really loses all that quality of this very special environment of the city that some of the shoddy new ones still have a little bit.
Architecture historian Vincent Scully is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is architecture historian and Yale professor emeritus, Vincent Scully. You've described the major change in your own perspective as being from going from a more religious philosophical position to a more social functional position. Would you describe that shift?
Well, I think now a third stage has entered, the typical scholastic synthesis. And I think my situation now is more the religious one, condensed, to use a Freudian term, with the social one, with the social concern.
What's the difference between the religious philosophical position and the social functional one?
I wrote those lines in the late 60s, which is a time when, like a lot of other people, I was politicized. And art history for me before that was really a wonderful way to enjoy life, enjoy things. There's no doubt that in the 60s, especially with the Vietnam War, which I regarded as destructive to the United States, as a brutalization of our civilization, I became politicized. And I began to go to anti-Vietnam demonstrations. And I used to wear the suit I'm wearing now. Like Norman Mailer, I didn't want to be taken for a hippie, so I always wore a very prison-like suit when I went to those things. And at the same time, redevelopment came along. And I began to see that in architecture, it wasn't just an affair of enjoying these beautiful buildings, that in fact, a redevelopment was destroying our cities. It was tearing the fabric of our lives apart. And in curious ways, there was a lot of the same kind of arrogance and knowing what was good for other people, which was directing our efforts in Vietnam. So I began to connect the two. So that's when I wrote those lines, that I was becoming involved with a more social position. But my fundamental instinct always is obvious to me, is fundamentally religious.
What's a religious approach to architecture?
Well, I guess it's feeling that the world embodies the divinity somehow, and that the divinity is in nature, and that the things we build as human beings should, in fact, somehow recognize that, deal with it, try to be like it or contrast with it, take an issue. The great religious sites of the Americas, say like Teotihuacan, you have a principle in which you have the sacred mountain, and then the axis at Teotihuacan runs right to the mountain, and directly under the mountain and echoing the mountain shape is the temple of the moon. And it abstracts and clarifies the shape and nature. And the mountain behind it, which is called Tenan, Our Lady of Stone, is running with springs. And the temple base is fractured horizontally as if it's being compressed like a mountain squeezing its water out. And it's drawing the water down into the Valley of Mexico. So that what you have is the principle of man-made forms imitating natural forms but trying to help them along. That's one thing. And the Greek, you see, has a different view. It's the Greek who changes the whole game, in which all of a sudden the Greek temple does not reflect a natural shape at all, but the columns look like the vertically standing columns of human beings. The temple is organized like a Greek phalanx, as a bunch of hoplites in a solid, a very man-made human cultural configuration. The divinity, as imagined by mankind, stands in the temple. The divinity in the landscape, in the conical hill and the Horn Mountain, stands outside it. And in that confrontation between nature's reality and what human beings want, how they project in their own divinity, is the tragic stature of Greek thought. Nature is real. Nature, in the end, always wins. But human beings have these great hopes. They have these aspirations. They defy nature. And out of that comes, you know, the ultimate, wonderful, resonant tragedy of human life.
When you walk around American cities now, what do you feel like the next step needs to be architecturally?
Well, I think the step that comes right to mind immediately is a human step as well as an architectural one, and that is our cities are dying. Our cities are coming apart. The whole fabric of the city is coming apart, and the lives of human beings are coming apart.
What do you see as being the role of architects in trying to save the cities?
I think it's exactly the same role that they have when they're putting a building in relation to pre-existing buildings. That is to say, the basic principle which has developed in the last generation is just the opposite of the late modern principle of invention at all costs. It's the principle of contextuality, which really is the principle of the architect not thinking of himself as an epic hero who reinvents the wheel, but as a kind of physician who tries to heal the specific wounds that he finds in the city. So Robert Venturi in Philadelphia is absolutely the most important from this point of view, in which every building of his grows out of the particular character of the place, which he tries to make a little better on its own terms. So style, with which the 19th century and the international style was preoccupied, becomes much less important than context. So one of his buildings will be vaguely Tudorish. Another one will be straight international style. Another one, as in the great Sainsbury addition to the National Gallery in London, will be classical, depending upon what the pre-existing buildings on the site are and what is needed to complete them, make the place a little better on its own terms. Well, I think it's exactly that principle in the city. It's not these vast programs of social engineering, but it is, in fact, going directly to the wounds and trying to heal them. And those wounds, of course, are jobs, housing, education. There they are. They need to be healed. It seems to me the principle is exactly the same.
What kind of home do you live in?
Well, at the present, I live in a house of about 19.5. It's kind of a late shingle-style house. Modest in size, in New Haven, within walking distance of Yale, where I still teach. Before that, we lived in a tiny little house in Brantford, which is on the water near New Haven, because my wife and I row all the time, almost every day. And when we're down around, we could row out. But we got tired of living in the automobile world, of driving in and out. And the curious thing is, about the only place you really can get away from the automobile now is right in the center of town, right in the eye of the storm. So we don't have to use it. Normally we walk in and out, and we enjoy it more. The dog enjoys it more. There are more different roads and pathways and so on to walk on. Sidewalks are great. The trees are wonderful. I mean, so we like it a lot. Once, many, many years ago, right after the war, like everybody else, I wanted to live in the suburbs. And I wanted to design a house which was not designed, which was just the simplest kind of house. And I did, which was very, very cheap. It was like a poor man's Philip Johnson's glass house. It was just a central core with a bathroom and kitchen, and then all open around it. And the core was cinder block, and the ceiling structure was open, heavy beams, and that's all. And then there were movable storage units, and we had three kids in there and a great wuzzle all together. But that's really the kind of architecture I still like best, where the individual is all alone in nature, right? But see, you can't build a town that way. There was nowhere to go from that. It was a wonderful dream. In a way, it was the ideal and the climax of modern architecture. In a way, Johnson's glass house is exactly that. There's nothing between you and nature. You plug into the going sources of power so you stay warm and so on, but you're just open to the rhythm of the seasons. But what can you do with it? You have to learn how to build houses in relation to each other in a community situation to have an overall environment.
Sure, if you've got a glass house.
Glass house has to be in the midst of emptiness.
Right, otherwise you're just looking into your neighbors.
Sure,
it's a peeping Tom domicile, you know?
Makes no sense at all, yeah.
So I've got one last question for you. Do people ever confuse you, Vincent Scully, with Vin Scully, the baseball announcer?
Occasionally, especially when I lecture on the West Coast. I remember many, many years ago, I went out there and there were funny signs around in UCLA or wherever I was lecturing, saying he's going to tell us about Sandy Koufax or somebody. Then another time, when I was making a movie for the Met, and they wanted to put us up in a hotel.
The Met, not the Mets.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, yeah. They wanted to put us up in a hotel on the West Side, but I wanted to stay in a very nice hotel near the Met, and they put us up there, and we got a wonderful room. Everybody was enormously respectful to us and so on. And one day at the desk, a fellow at the desk said, what do you think of the Yanks' chances this year? And I said, they never should have gotten rid of Reggie. I thought that was the thing to say at that moment. But I guess they detected somehow that I wasn't the real McCoy. So next time we had a very small room. So we have, a very strange thing about him. I understand that his three children are named Daniel, Stephen, and John. His first three children, this may not be true, but I understand it's true. And my first three children named Daniel, Stephen, and John.
Huh.
It's weird.
So are people disappointed when they find out that...
Desperately disappointed. They ask me, are you the Vin Scully? And of course, I always say, of course, yes, naturally. But that's not what they mean.
Well, Vincent Scully, thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Vincent Scully has a new book called Architecture, The Natural and the Man-Made. He also wrote the introduction to the catalog accompanying an exhibition of the work of architect Louis Kahn. The Kahn Show is currently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have a report from Mike Schuster in Moscow on the news that Eduard Shevardnadze is returning as foreign minister of the Soviet Union. Remember, Shevardnadze resigned a year ago or so, a warning of a coup. He's one of Mikhail Gorbachev's first partners in the perestroika and the reform restructuring movement of the Soviet Union. And we'll see what his return is likely to mean. Margot Adler reports today on a real-life Field of Dreams in the Bronx, New York, where a Dominican immigrant has managed to build a baseball field, which in the winter is a football and soccer field for the neighborhood kids to play on, and a discussion of the role of the drug czar and what it should be.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tomorrow night on ABC, the latest weekly series from Stephen Bochco Productions makes its premiere. It's called Civil Wars. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Civil Wars isn't about the war between the states. It's about what James Thurber called the war between men and women. It's about divorce attorneys in Manhattan, and its stars are Mariel Hemingway, who starred in Woody Allen's Manhattan, and Peter Onorati, the toughest cop on Cop Rock. Oh, and one more thing I ought to say right up front. Based on the four episodes I've seen so far, Civil Wars is the best new drama series of the year. It's got heart, which few new shows have this year, and it's got an edge, which makes it stand virtually alone. Even the opening credits pack a punch. There's soft piano music playing, and the images are a montage of old home movie clips of kids and families playing together, kind of like the opening of The Wonder Years. Except that while these happy pictures are being shown, we hear the hard-hitting courtroom dialogue of some of the Civil War's divorce proceedings.
In other words, you agreed to pay for your child's tuition.
That's right.
And now you're reneging.
That's right, I'm reneging. You're not seriously suggesting that your husband turned your dog against you, are you, ma'am?
Yes, I am. That dog relieved himself on every article of clothing I own.
Sir, for right now, you are the witness and I am an attorney conducting cross-examination.
You broads are all alike.
You mean the mortgage and the tuition and the food and clothing?
Everything. Under the terms of the separation agreement, you pay for everything.
It's tough stuff, but Civil Wars, like Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law, also has its tender and funny moments. In addition, it has one potential advantage over those shows, a core cast of only three people. There are Onorati and Hemingway, who are excellent as the attorneys who decide to share office space, and Debbie Mazar, who plays their flashy-dressing legal secretary. And that's it. And that's a bonus, because it gives series creator William Finkelstein, director Gregory Hoblit, executive consultant Botchko, and co-executive producer Mark Tinker plenty of room to play. Instead of writing for a sea of regulars, they can bring in guest stars and use them to the fullest. And since the producers of Civil Wars come from either L.A. Law or St. Elsewhere, they're inclined to stretch themselves and surprise viewers. The best surprise in the pilot episode comes from a subplot involving a woman who's divorcing her husband because he thinks he's the reincarnation of Elvis Presley. The surprise isn't the outrageousness of the conflict, that's an old L.A. Law stock in trade, but it's the fact that Murray Seidelman, this reborn Elvis, is played by an almost unrecognizable Dennis Franz, who played Norman Bunce on Hill Street. Here he is on the witness stand being cross-examined by Onorati, who plays Charlie Howell.
Well, listen, other than the so-called expert testimony of Dr. Zelnick that we heard yesterday, have you ever seen a psychiatrist?
Now, why would I see a psychiatrist?
Because you keep acting like Elvis Presley.
Okay. Now, I'm going to make this as simple as I know how to make it, son. You see, there's been a visitation. Murray Seidelman has left the building, and the king has moved on in.
Civil Wars is also fun because of the chemistry between Onorati and Hemingway. Peter Onorati was my favorite actor in Cop Rock, and I watched him and it do some great things, even though no one else seemed to be tuning in. On Civil Wars, they'll finally see what they were missing. And they'll also see Mariel Hemingway finally getting an adult role with some meat to it and handling it beautifully.
Come on, look at you. You're young, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're successful. You married?
No.
You're single. What could be bad?
How about I'm overworked, my partner's in a mental institution, my ex-husband owes me money, I don't have time for a social life, and I spend my days rummaging through the garbage of other people's ruined marriages.
I guess if you look at it that way, it does sound kind of depressing.
Last season, when ABC canceled Cop Rock, Twin Peaks, Equal Justice, and China Beach, the network tossed out all the interesting, worthwhile dramas it had. Now, with Civil Wars, it's back on the right track.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Richard Wright's 1940 novel, Native Son, is a classic work of African-American fiction. But the scenes relating to the main character's sexuality were deleted at the request of the publisher. A new edition of Richard Wright's works reinstates those passages. A reading and a discussion on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.